I'm very happy now to welcome Yochai Benkler. He is a professor for entrepreneurial legal studies at Harvard Law School, and he will be in Santa Fe giving a lecture titled The Penguin and the Leviathan, the Science and Practice of Cooperation. That's tonight, Wednesday, the 13th of October at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater here in Santa Fe, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure. Nice to be with you.
Thank you. You've been observing various kinds of organizations whose structures are based on human cooperation rather than control, both in web-based phenomena like Wikipedia and in traditional business. And to give our listeners a sense of this comparison, maybe you could talk for a moment about the example of Toyota and General Motors.
So the study of Toyota and General Motors very much launched a whole area of study in management studies, because for a long time people saw differences between U.S. firms and Japanese firms in terms of the structure of relations, but it was assigned to cultural differences. In 1980, one of GM's worst-performing plants in Fremont, California, shut down. And it opened up 2 years later under an arrangement between Toyota and GM that transformed the shop floor. Instead of 70 engineers on the floor, everyone was organized in teams. Instead of each individual having one place and one job at the assembly line, the teams had more flexibility, more room for experimentation. There were no process engineers on the floor. Eventually, there was much more room for employee input into the structure of production. The idea being that you can't fully control every bit of information that you need to the same extent that people can learn and innovate. But in order to allow people to learn and innovate, you need to bring in more freedom of action and therefore to engage people's affection and engagement. And in fact, what you saw with that plant is that for the next 20 years, it moved from being one of the worst in the GM system to one of the top three in productivity in the U.S. With the same employees. The same thing happened with regard to supplier relationship. Again, the same idea of everyone is self-interested. So if it's on the shop floor, the workers will try to shirk and you have to monitor. That was the model of the classic self-interested rationality. With suppliers, the same thing. You have to get them into competitive bidding, otherwise they'll give you shoddy stuff. That's the idea of self-interest, putting it into systems that leverage self-interest to get you to behave better. That was competitive bidding. The Japanese approach was much more closer to collaborative relationships, long-term relationships with suppliers. Again, you find that when those firms moved, and this is not only Toyota, but also Honda, when those firms moved to the U.S., they worked with the same U.S. suppliers on different relations and got higher quality relations. Even at the level of the executive compensation, the same model applied of self-interested rationality required high compensation and stock options so that the executives in GM would be aligned with the interest of the shareholders. In Japan, they were a fraction of the same size. So you saw organizations with very different theories, a theory of self-interest driving all the way from compensation at the top through supplier relations to the shop floor. And on the other hand, a model of a range of motivations. It's not just, this wasn't about altruism. It was about a sense of some greater degree of freedom, some greater degree of fairness and trust, and continuing communication and adjustment and processes to treat each other more fairly, again, from the shop floor through suppliers all the way to the top. The result was over 20 years, the relative rise of Toyota and similar phenomena in other of the Japanese automakers versus the U.S. Automakers.
So basically, the idea that the more you pay people, the better they will do, that's on the executive compensation level, turns out not really to be true. And in the same way, the more you control people, the better profits you'll have, turns out also not to be true.
I think that's right. I think that's if I had to say what the core idea that I'm trying to explore and explain in this talk, in the book that will come out of it, in other work, is that we've been perfecting for decades a cramped view of human motivation and human behavior. And through that cramped view, we've been trying to perfect systems of control and incentives, reward and punishment, that are oriented toward treating people as basically having a very thin, one-dimensional, motivational character, or in economics it would usually be thought of as a utility function, and you try to maximize. And reality turns out not to work that way. And because we've spent so much time in so many disciplines perfecting that narrow view, as evidence has mounted that that doesn't work, we have relatively weaker tools at our hands to say, okay, now that I understand this is false, how do I design a better organization? We have stories to tell, like the story I just told about GM and Toyota. We have some experimental work, a good bit of experimental work, but that's removed. There's a lot of work on online collaboration, but we really are at the nascent stage of converting all of these into something that would be a science of cooperative human systems design based on the much more varied sense of who we are and how we respond and how our motivations work out.
When you look at ecosystems, you have models of both self-interest and cooperation right in front of us. How does ecosystem science play into the work that you're doing?
Primarily, the work that one of the phenomena that's very clear is that in different areas of science, we've seen an arc or trajectory, not only in economics, towards recognizing greater role for cooperation. So the closest in this regard is evolutionary biology, that starting in the early to mid-60s, really began to shift away from group-level explanations to individual explanations. And so you saw a limitation that whenever you see cooperation, it's really kin selection. So really what you're talking about is the same gene replicating, or kin selection. Slowly you saw, that is to say, I will only sacrifice for a brother or a cousin rather than for someone who's not genetically related. Then you saw increases with a move to direct reciprocity. That is to say, I will help you if on average your help to me is worth more to me than what I gave to you. Again, very much on the model of self-interest, ending up with really this concept of the selfish gene. I think what's been happening for the last 15 years or so is work that has explored how, in addition to these levels of very narrow cooperation, we're also seeing indirect reciprocity, which gets much harder to explain simply from trade-offs. This is the idea of pay it forward. I'll help you knowing that in some sense, on average, someone will help me, but it becomes much, much harder to treat that as pure self-interest, and it actually becomes not clearly adaptive to have a psyche that constantly calculates if you have to calculate at the margin as opposed to living in a system. More importantly than that, you're beginning to see what 20 years ago people talking about multi-level selection, or what today people talk about as multi-level selection or group selection, was heresy. Today, it's one of the menus of ways in which we understand organisms developing. So one of the aspects of ecosystem science that really seems to be moving in the same direction is specifically within concepts of evolutionary biology. Another dimension is network science. And as you see efforts to study how people behave, one of the things that we see is some form of local imitation and learning. So, for example, there are experiments that look at whether or not individuals cooperate as a function of who are their network neighbors, in other words, who they see. And this is on the experimental side rather than the field side. And so you're beginning to see studies that are showing that who is next to you and how they behave becomes a very important predictor of whether or not you'll be cooperative. And cooperative, I mean contribute to a public good, do something that's somehow a sacrifice of your own self-interest for some other person or some collective good. So again, so we're seeing network science beginning to be applied to explore both theoretically and experimentally how we get cooperation. So different components play into the same path, putting together different pieces, one in terms of understanding the benefits to a group, in particular culture and cultural evolution playing a role to how different cultural traits and institutions can evolve to support cooperation at the expense of suppressing individual self-interest. Suppressing not in the formal put you down with punishment. That's exactly the opposite of the idea of Leviathan, but rather that institutions develop so that we actually internally want to cooperate and harness the kind of social motivations that drive us to be generous, to help someone, to do something that we understand is good for a society. And at the same time, also allowing us to see how we simply conform. That when we see, for example, in one experiment, that people around us intend to pay taxes fairly, it turns out we claim fewer deductions. So we're trying to model ourselves on others next to us.
Right. We're talking to Yochai Benkler, professor for entrepreneurial and legal studies at Harvard Law School. This transition, which seems to be a pretty big historical transition, seems transition in thinking and ways of doing organizations and so on, seems to coincide also with the vast increase in the number of women in higher education and in the professions. And I was wondering if, in your view, the influence of women plays a role in this cultural change and way of thinking.
It's very hard to nail down what the particular influence of women is on this transition. There aren't that many studies that try to separate out distinctly gender effects in pro-social behavior. What there is not entirely crisp in terms of understanding whether, in fact, women do or don't respond to certain kinds of prosociality or another. We obviously know the work coming out of Carol Gilligan's work that lineage about certain views of women as having more prosocial motivations, relational, that particular line in work in psychology. And so that could fit, but part of the problem with saying that is that it's equally true that there are dynamics of solidarity and intergroup competition that also can play in teams. And there the evidence is much more varied. But, for example, a study that I did with some of my collaborators suggested that actually the stronger effect was actually, or the serious effect was primarily in young males, which, again, is consistent with some model that we might see, whether it's in sports team or in military, where you get self-sacrifice through intergroup competition. So I think there's very interesting work on gender differences in responsiveness to different kind of design levers. There's fascinating work, for example, on the impact of offering to pay for blood donations in Sweden that seemed to have real differences in effect between men and women, where men didn't really respond at all and women responded negatively to offering money. But these are really early explorations. And since pro-social behavior is triggered by very different mechanisms, some of which we in our baseline cultural assumptions code as female in terms of relationship communication, etc., and some of which we code traditionally or historically male, like intergroup competition or stark claims of morality, of formal morality as opposed to interpersonal engagement. I think we actually have a general problem of how to build systems in which we don't each pursue our own self-interest. And that we've developed a menu of institutional, social, psychological interventions that then map onto a population that has both men and women. And then when we begin to learn the gender differences better, we might be able to also diagnose which aspects of these systems are responsive more to culturally traditional roles conceptions of women's interactions as opposed to men. But I think that at the moment, it's an interesting area that some people are working in. It's too soon to tell whether or not it's the relative increase in gender equality that is the driver, or whether it's a major component of what needs to be solved for, essentially responded to.
Right. When you talk about this, and I was reading some of your writings and so on, it seems incredibly, I have to say, obvious that people would want to work in conditions where they are trusted, where they have a certain amount of freedom and autonomy, where they work together in cooperation with one another, rather than doing, say, routine assembly line tasks where they're repetitive and where they don't have any autonomy, and where somebody is breathing down their neck and so on. What's mysterious is why anyone would have ever thought the opposite at all. It sort of seems to, the previous model seems to divide people into very much us and them, us who can be trusted and them, the workers, who have to be tightly controlled.
So it's not just workers. The same attitude also applies to managers, and the idea that shareholders have to monitor managers very carefully, otherwise the managers will shirk their responsibilities. And the idea of very high powered incentives were only for people at the very top of the line, and then somewhere below that, very close monitoring and reward. I think the general, I think it's important to recognize that the general model of self-interested rationality was mathematically very crisp, fit certain aspects of this robust individualism that we like to see as quite central to liberal societies in the North Atlantic, and in particular in the U.S., very powerfully a sense of rugged individualism. I'm for myself, not for the other, at least not in a context where except outside of my family or a very close group. And so we had these very strong, mathematically robust predictions that turned out not to be true in reality. But it takes a long time for reality to catch up with very powerful mathematical models. Now, the thing about the prediction is not that people won't enjoy having a lot of freedom in the joints to decide their own work. The prediction is that people will end up doing that, but spending some of their time working on their own stuff and not actually contributing to the common purpose. If the common purpose, say, is a corporate job, then they'll do what's good for them. If the common purpose is contributing to a fund to build a bridge or pay your taxes, then you're perfectly happy to spend it on something else. So the point is not that people won't enjoy a lot more freedom in their structure. The point is that they'll abuse it so as not to contribute as much to the common good. That, I think, is not intuitively unclear. What's intuitively, in some sense, perhaps more difficult is to see that actually people work harder and contribute more and essentially do more for the common good when they're not required to, when they're not monitored, when it comes from the inside, and that that's measurable. So one example that I'll talk about tonight is a new study that some students and I have done on the music industry. And there you see a classic instance where the industry assumes that people will want music, but assumes that they won't want to pay them. And so you get this systematic effort to control through technological protection measures, through law, through criminal enforcement, through civil cases, to force payment. And the idea is fans don't want to pay artists. Well, it turns out when they actually look at artists who function differently and have a very different relationship with their fans and don't try to control using these systems but actually engage socially, it turns out the artists, at least in the data that we found, which is substantial, a good 3 to 5 years worth of data, there is a decent level of voluntary contributions, and the artists on the downloading side are actually no worse off than they are with the traditional record deals. That becomes counterintuitive.
Right.
And I think that's what we're beginning, that the evidence is forcing us, but also helping us to begin to see.
We're talking to Yochai Benkler, professor for entrepreneurial and legal studies at Harvard Law School. There are some people, as you write, who, whatever the system is, remain quite selfish. And I was thinking about a model in which people have a certain amount of freedom, they contribute more to the greater good when they have that freedom, and so on. When you take it out a level from the individual company to the society, you find that in society there are some very selfish actors, like, let's say, fossil fuel companies whose selfishness is damaging to their own society and to the greater world through climate change, but they refuse to engage in any kind of cooperative thinking at all or actions. How do you think about these types of situations? Is it possible to create incentives that work on these fundamentally truly selfish actors at such a massive scale of power and money?
So these are, in many senses, the big challenges of this field. I can begin to give you a direction that I think it will go, but I think that we really are only at a stage now where we're ready to begin to attack these as research questions, much less as direct implementation. That said, I think, first of all, that it's very difficult and potentially dangerous to abstract from individuals to companies. Companies work as organizations. They have different roles. They have internal dynamics that themselves are systems that already have individuals within them. And so one of the things, for example, that we need to study is the extent to which when people are in a particular kind of role, like being CEO or some other high position in a firm, or when somebody's a lobbyist or a lawyer, whether actually some of the inhibitions that we have in our interpersonal relations disappear because we suddenly have some other moral commitment. And if that's the case, then we need to see, do we need to begin to work more on education and professional ethics of the people who move into the firms and the people who represent them? And the solution needs to be much longer term and more foundational in terms of changing our understanding of the role of people within firms. That's a speculation at the moment, but there's an experimental agenda to try to understand the role of agency and to try to understand the role of normative appeals or moral appeals within that system, and then to try to apply it beyond that. But I think more generally, one of the things that we do see in the experimental work, for sure, is that there is a stable minority, quite substantial. Often, if you had to do it back of the envelope, you'd probably say something like 30%, give or take, who will play in a self-interested way. And for those people, certainly in some of the work, there's monitoring, there's punishment, there's reward, but it's complicated because one of the problems we have at the moment is we focus so much on controlling the self-interested actors that we build a whole system around controlling everyone because we don't know who is who. And so we lose many of the opportunities of the more collaborative and trusting models in the context of trying to restrain and contain self-interested actors. So one of the things we're going to begin to learn is how to use issues like reputation, like education, combined with very clear communications about what's being punished and why, to be able to restrain some forms of self-interested action without undermining others. I'll give you an example, not at the very large corporate level, but at the level of crime and crime control. So the shift to from, so we have these two models. We have a model of three strikes and you're out, and we have a model of community policing. What's more self-interested than basically grabbing from the other? Well, it's complicated, of course. It turns out that, there are a lot of social drivers. It's not necessarily self-interest. You might actually be a highly pro-social person who's a member of a gang and opposed to some other group and behave in ways that are socially disruptive to people outside, but that are not actually selfish. And so there you see a system that gets designed away from perfect rationality, self-interest, crime times punishment times probability of detection will mean lower crime, to something that's much more engaged. Whether the same thing can work at a corporate level when it's not individuals but agency, whether you can actually create more collaborative models, very hard to predict based on current research, but an absolutely central question. And the direction is likely to be, to some extent, in education of the people who work in these professions, to some extent in distinct legal responsibility that is about monitoring and punishment, and to some extent building and permitting relations that are that break down these walls and bring people much more to see each other and their various needs in human terms, rather than simply across the border of the boundary between the firm and society.
Yochai Benkler is professor for entrepreneurial legal studies at Harvard Law School. His lecture tonight is called The Penguin and the Leviathan, The Science and Practice of Cooperation. It's a public lecture at the James A. Little Theater tonight at 7:30 here in Santa Fe, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.